This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, Tuesday, April 29th. My gosh, it was only yesterday that I had a birthday. Public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Department-wide Support Services. And Ms. Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Last week, we delivered to your offices the Legislative Fiscal Office orientation and overview for this budget. There may be some copies on the table. Since I made some extra copies for the public, but there don't appear to be a lot of public people here. For once, I may have made an adequate number of copies.
I think you delivered them on Friday.
I believe it was Thursday. I had my daughter here for take
Thursday.
Your daughter to work day, and she was running errands for me. It was wonderful.
That's great.
Yeah.
Get those kids to work.
Yeah. She doesn't want to work here when she grows up, though.
Yeah. Well, you know, she's too young to make that decision. You need to influence her more.
I'll start on this background and orientation paper then, just take a few minutes. The department-wide support services function is the administrative arm for many of the central functions that are required to run the programs and services that the department offers. It includes the director's office and some of those centralized administrative services. If you look at the PowerPoint pages that I've attached to the memo, the first page shows basically how the functions are laid out. Within the office of the director, you have your general leadership, policy, and administrative oversight. The director's office also includes the governor's advocacy office, the children's ombudsman, which is operated under an interagency agreement with the Commission on Children and Families, and the pain management program. There is also an internal audit and consulting function in the office of the director. Finance and policy analysis is responsible for the centralized budgeting, rate setting, and then caseload forecasting as well. And then the bulk of the department-wide support services budget is administrative services, which includes financial services such as accounting, contracts, procurement, communications facilities, the information systems piece, human resources, and then forms and document management. The next page shows you a little bit historical perspective on the growth in this budget. Because of the shift of administrative functions to centralized offices, over time this budget has grown, particularly in 1996 when the first push to bring services in to a central unit was started, and then more recently there was another push with the department's reorganization this biennium. So you can see the 2001-03 approved budget there was significantly higher than the adopted because of emergency board actions during the interim that shifted some administrative functions from the various programs and divisions, or programs and offices, into the central administrative piece here. I would note for the governor's budget, it looks like there's a significant general fund decline there. This is a hard budget to look at an apples and apples comparison to because of the reorganization and because as part of its reorganization efforts this time, the agency did a new federal cost allocation plan and got rid of what it called its prorate. That is, it used to charge the divisions back for central administrative services and collect other funds, which it then spent in its budget to cover those costs of those central administrative functions. That prorate is still included in the governor's budget as other funds, and those other funds, as we get into the reshoot and the final adjustments on this budget, those other funds will come out. It's about $120 million worth of other funds. The other piece of that is once those other funds come out, what this budget will reflect is additional general fund and federal fund expenditures showing more closely the actual source of the funds from the program areas. For example, if they're providing services, central support services for children, adults, and families, then children, adults, and families budget general fund will come into this budget and will be shown as general fund as opposed to other fund. So it gets very complicated very fast, but the bottom line is that this general fund, other fund, and federal fund split that you see here, we expect to be significantly different once the final adjustments are done to this budget for legislatively adopted. But in terms of how the budget has grown as a result of the centralization, this page does show you that. The next page shows a distribution of the full-time equivalent positions. It is perhaps surprising if you haven't looked at this budget to see where the staff are allocated. You can see that the information systems FTE make up almost 42% of this budget. Other administrative services such as human resources, facilities, make up about 24% of the budget. Financial services, the accounting function, make up about 22% of the budget. Then you can see fiscal and policy analysis, which is the budget and rate setting and forecasting positions, is a little less than 8% of the budget. The director's office itself is about 3% of the budget. And the continuous system improvement unit, as it was included in the governor's budget, is about 2%. Now, the agency has been looking at that and is going to be making some changes there. So, again, that will change as we get into the legislatively adopted budget. The next page just shows, as with other parts of this agency, that budget growth is closely tied to the program and policy changes, both on the state and federal level. The reorganization of the department brought more administrative and support services into DWSS, department-wide support services, and then federal and state program and policy mandates directly affect administrative practices and information system requirements, and I've listed some notable examples there. The Oregon Health Plan Medicaid expansion, to the extent that the information system for the Medicaid program prior to the health plan was basically a fee-for-service type system, and the Oregon Health Plan both added complexity in terms of managed care and number of people on the plan, there was significant work needed and continuing work needed on their Medicaid management information system. The Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act had a significant impact not only on information systems in the agency, but also in how, in terms of training and providing information to staff, both in the program offices and out in the field, in terms of meeting the requirements of that federal law. And then the Adoption and Safe Families Act is an example of where there was money added on the program side, but there were also significant administrative and additional reporting requirements required because of that federal law. So, again, the bottom line is, as programs go, so go the administrative services. And particularly as we look at budgets, and particularly in the new configuration of the department, there, in terms of having centralized services, sometimes there is a potential of disconnect between the impact of the program changes on administrative services. And as we look at this budget, that is something that I think you'll want to keep in mind. back to the cover memo now. I've listed the budget notes from last session. There is a budget note that talks about performance-based contracts and agreements with providers, local governments, and other funded parties. There is a budget note relative to the reorganization savings and expected reinvestment of that. And then there was a budget note related to several priority information systems. And so the department has provided information in the materials that you've gotten, and they will talk about that as we go through their information. I've also noted the audit reports during this interim. There's been some discussion of some of those in other forums, but I wanted to make sure that you knew that those audits had been done. There were no significant other interim reports or studies. There were several reports to the House Interim Task Force on the Department of Human Services reorganization during the interim, and also Joint Legislative Committee on Information Management and Technology received several reports related to the information systems pieces. I put down two bullets in terms of what I see as relevant issues. One is, how much central administrative capacity do you need to meet basic business needs? And that would include monitoring, reporting requirements, accounting, human resources, all those kinds of functions that an entity needs to keep going. Is there an optimum level? How do we know when we get there? What do we use for benchmarks in terms of determining how much needs to be done? And that, I think, is a critical question, not necessarily one I have an answer to at this point, but something to keep in mind as we go through here. And then the other bullet that I think is pertinent is, what are the effects of the budget reductions on information systems needs? The Medicaid Management Information System replacement, you'll hear, is an ongoing project. There have been savings, if you will, this biennium, that have been taken out of that project. There was a new system being developed for mental health and developmental disability services payments because of the increased caseload associated with the Staley agreement for serving persons with developmental disabilities. And then, as I mentioned, the Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act had some information systems requirements that were tied to that. So the pressure to keep budget expenditures down has impacted these system pieces, but I believe the committee needs to take a look at what is the agency doing as they move forward now into the next biennium. So that
Sheila, can you tell me if when you look at the budget notes and the request number one under the first bullet, if the measurable outcomes were the kind of outcomes that the department was looking for, and if so, did it say were there savings, financial savings there? Under the second bullet, the dollars that are scheduled here as savings, as requested by the governor, does this take in consideration the reductions that the co-chairs are asking for us in the 0305 session? And I'll wait for the next one. But if we, do you think?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think I'll let the agency, if that's all right with you, address the first bullet.
Okay.
The second bullet, these were 2001-03 savings that the department was to identify, and then the idea was that they could reinvest those in particular projects. And so because of other reductions taken during 0103, it was very difficult for them to identify reductions. They have at this point identified about $5.7 million, I believe, towards that $6 million total. Only about $2.4 million of that is actually going to be reinvested. The rest has been offered up, if you will, as part of the reductions during this interim. So they've almost achieved the $6 million savings there, but they've only been able to reinvest about $2.4 million because of the budget constraints. It doesn't have a direct impact on 2003-2005 in terms of how the co-chair's budget was built. They did not make additional reductions or reinvestment decisions relative to this particular $6 million.
Madam Chair, to you. My concern is that I think it's so easy to look in human services for savings, and with them not having had the opportunity to rebalance, let alone our directions from you in terms of looking at budgets and trying to find some cost savings there, I consider this a little cumbersome feat that we have before us. And what are your expectations in terms of us accomplishing that?
Well, first and you're correct, because we still have the rebalance to go yet, and that isn't completed. And before we do the rebalance, we can't get into the nitty-gritty of the rest of the budget, as well as we still have the reshoot left yet to come forward. So there's two major actions on the part that we still have to go through before we get down to really looking at budget efficiencies and some of those issues. With respect to the expectation of the department realizing $6 million in savings, in the 2002-03 budget, I think the bigger picture was it was $10 million. And four of those we took. So I needed to set that on the record, because it was 10. We took four of them, which left the remaining six for reinvestment. And because of actions with the reduction over time, you know, it was that even that six eroded for the department, to where you're only talking about perhaps only $2 million that they've had to reinvest. I need to put that on record, because I know question's going to come up someplace. I thought it was $10 million that the agency was going to save. And that was the target that we had given them. And then we said, well, of that $10 million, we will take the four, which is what we what the legislative body did.
Sheila.
I think we can go in.
Okay. Jean, would you join us? Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you too, Madam
like
Chair.
I've been on vacation.
I wish.
Okay, I'll take it back.
I've been keeping an eye. Madam Chair, I'm Jean Thorne, Director of the Department of Human Services, and I think this is, I was saying earlier, it's like the last lap of your 3-month marathon presentation on the Department of Human Services budget. What we'll be doing this week, today, tomorrow, and Thursday, is giving you the overview then of the Director's Office. Jim Neely will speak more about that. Then we'll move into Administrative Services. Clyde Psyche will do that. And then, who's our Chief Administrative Officer, John Cuddy, who's our Chief Information Officer, will go into more detail around information technology. And then Thursday we'll have the Finance and Policy Analysis and wrap up with whatever you have. In your binders, there's a front of the binder is senior and persons with disabilities, and towards the back you'll find a red tab, department-wide support services, and the second tab under that is they're letting me present one page, so I'll see if I can drag it out a little bit. Actually, there's a little bit more to present than that. I think, as Sheila noted, we really have been going through for the last several biennia slowly centralizing more and more administrative functions. I know when I left the agency in 95, we were just beginning to centralize some of the functions, and it really was finally accomplished during the current biennium. By forming the administrative services as a cluster, where we brought in some of the final functions, and really bringing the budget staff in and information technology staff in. Most of what we do really is it's direct support to those programs. And so as you deal, as you move further on, for instance, on priority lists, we'll need to be able, like as Sheila said, we have to be able to tease out as program decisions are made, what kind of impact does that have on the various functions in administrative services and department-wide support services, whether it's a production function or some other function that supports that. I think the sense I have in terms of what we have accomplished by centralizing the services, and you'll see at the bottom of 2-1 all of the various kinds of business functions that have been centralized, it's allowed us for more consistency in our policies, our procedures, and our resourcing among these areas. I think, you know, one of the things I can certainly point to of a difference between when I left the department and when I came back is, for instance, in human resources. We had had seven different human resources shops before, and the approach they may have taken to classification of positions, to disciplinary issues, those kinds of issues may have been somewhat different. And it was noticeably different. I think that we have much more consistency across the department on those issues now. And we see that in our contracting and other areas. We've been able to...
Can we go back to the contracting piece? Because that was my first question to Sheila. When I looked under the first bullet, it was talking about how you were going toward performance-based contracts. And I'm wondering if under those performance measures, be they programmatic or performance objectives in terms of the financing piece of it, what can we appoint to? What can we point to that led to performance being number one higher? As a result of the performance being higher, how much were the savings?
Madam Chair, I'll let Clyde answer this since contracting is under his arena.
Senator Carter, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Psyche. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the department and didn't expect to be up here this early, but I will let
you are.
Answer your question. Really, we are in, I guess, kind of the early stages of working out our performance-based contracting system. What we've done to date really is gathered, and where we decided to start was with our county contracts because so much of our money in mental health, in public health, and other services are administered through the county. So we have put together a task force which consists of county representatives as well as county councils who have a real interest in what we're doing around contracting. And we have actually got to a point where we've agreed on a format. We've agreed on a set of performance measures, and I don't remember right offhand which service we agreed to. And we've also selected a pilot county where within the next 4 or 5 months we'll be rolling that out. And then the group continues to meet to talk about rolling it out to other counties in the future. So we're on our way. It's just that we wanted to make sure that as we move forward, we were taking into consideration all the factors because it is a big step for us at this point in time.
Senator Carter, coming back to my first bullet, I was asking about performance, programmatic, and financially. Gene, the reason I'm asking that question, how do we let our partners, say, a county like Multnomah County, go so far awry of mental health issues? You know what I'm saying? And not how do we allow that to happen, but what kind of accountabilities we have in place so that when the county is not performing to the performance measures set out by the department, something can be recognized before we get to the point where we are now. And even though Senator Gordley has been on this issue for the last 4 years, prior to that, I was on this issue. Even when we were looking at issues, Madam Chair, like going from a fee-for-service model to a managed care model, and some counties dragging their feet and not coming along, even though we were feeling real chilled by the fact that you were going to see this day that you guys had warned communities that we were going to see. So how can the state, you know, I know you hate to be big brother, big sister kind of thing,
But we're talking about accountability here. How do we do it so that we, now in Multnomah County, people like Senator Gordy and me, who are accountable to the people, Madam Chair, about mental health, I mean, you know, we're stymied. We don't know what to do, where to go, what to say. Because nobody seemed to be accountable. And that's why I'm asking about this.
Madam Chair and Senator Carter and Clyde can feel free to jump in if he has any answers to this. But I think, and I have to say, since the Multnomah County issue happened while I was gone, I don't know the details.
Right.
I know kind of where we are or where we were about a year ago. I think that, I mean, there are issues around contracting and having the right performance measurements in there that allow us to understand when both parties to understand what are the expectations and where are there steps that should be taken if those expectations aren't being met. I think even beyond the contracting, though, is that just in terms of generally in terms of program monitoring, there always is the fine line. And I can't speak specifically to the Multnomah County mental health issue, but it's the fine line when you're dealing with services that are necessary in a delivery system that's out there. How far do we go as a state in allowing practice that may be seen as temporary in order for that provider, whatever the case is, to get back on its feet and get things moving? And when do we're always having to balance of if we come down hard, what are the implications of that on our clients as well? So I don't know in terms of the performance contracting if there are some pieces that might be relevant.
If you don't mind me addressing the chair for a minute. Madam Chair, the reason I'm asking this question because I think it's absolutely wonderful that with Gene being on board, these performance measures are in place. But the concerns in Multnomah County has been over about a 5 or 6 year period of time. And so, I mean, I just want to see, not just as a legislator, but as a citizen of this state, I mean, no system should have to go down to the brink where the people in the county are having, those that are participants in the service delivery side, on the service delivery side, we're finding patients. You should walk in. I'd invite you guys to come and drive in our districts and seeing the conditions of the mentally ill. They're walking around in space with no service. This is abhorring.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Carter, I think there's probably about three different issues within there, and we have the issue of whatever what occurred with Multnomah County. The issue of performance-based contracting may be something that helps us in the future, but frankly, I think what we're dealing with right now in the area of mental health, there have been huge cuts just in the last few months between the November rebalance, the December allotment reductions, and Measure 28.
Well,
and those aren't especially a performance based contract issue. That's an issue of really having big cuts in services.
The push in this committee last session pushed for that's what was in the budget note for performance based contracting, mm-hmm. And it was my expectation that the agency was going to really work diligently with their partners, mm-hmm. to come up with performance-based standards in those contracts. You know, we've talked to the counties where most of your pass-through is going, that business as usual by the state would no longer be acceptable, recognizing that in the conduct of doing business, no matter what, you know, in the business, whether we're talking about the people business or whatever, that there had to be measurable outcomes. And so, you know, you're telling me today that you do have one pilot county.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe that's all well and good, but I think I would like to see you to begin talking about within each service area, and we went through it, Dr. Bates? Within each service area, I think we specifically said to all the silos between now and when you come back 2 years later, mm-hmm. that you will have performance measures, outcomes for all of the programs, whether we were talking about mental health, alcohol and drug, services to children and families. I think it was every category. Every budget was budget noted on this particular issue. And so just to have one pilot county, I don't think is sufficient. And it could be that if you don't have the contracting, the staff to do that, I think we need to know that. If you don't have the staff mm-hmm. to monitor, to follow up, to make sure things are occurring with your partners, we need to know that. But clearly, I think it was the intent of this body that you did develop, that you would develop over the past 2 years, some performance outcome measures with every program, not just mental health mm-hmm. and alcohol and mm-hmm. drug. And that, you know, it wasn't business as usual, so.
Madam Chair, we think that from this point on, it'll be a lot, we'll move a lot quicker on implementation. What we struggled with initially is just sitting down with our partners, and it was really a lot more difficult task than we anticipated, and actually getting to set performance measures, how they're going to be measured, at what level we would feel that the service was appropriate. And so I think a lot of that baseline, and of course our attorneys at DOJ and the county councils all had to weigh in on it. And I think at this point a lot of the groundwork and the foundation has been laid, and so we will be able, I anticipate, to move forward a lot quicker than we have up to this point.
Before you had conversation with Department of Justice, I think the basic outlines of the contract. It would, and I would think that from the standpoint of program, it would then be what you want to accomplish inside mm-hmm. of each one of those programs.
Right.
And then the construction of the contract would then take place. And so I think from this body, and I'd like to see what the constructs are. Mm-hmm. We were very concerned, for example, that in the area of, let's say, alcohol and drug, that what we were buying were beds and not treatment outcomes. Mm-hmm. I can remember our conversation last time. And so, you know, we would like to see that those contracts really move towards treatment outcomes. The same is true if we're talking about what's occurring in mental health. And particularly we were concerned about some communities who were taking their dollars and, you know, people may or may not have been getting treated, mm-hmm. but that was going into a reserve someplace, so they built a building. And all of this was, begged the question of what kind of monitoring, what kind of follow-up are we doing in the life of contracts. And so if you have something put together, I think that you could share with this panel, it would be much and greatly appreciated.
Madam Chair, we'll do that, and we'll provide that for the committee.
Because it was a huge issue for mm-hmm. the committee.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. With regard to the mental health area, what would be of interest to me, particularly as we talk about performance measures and how we move forward with performance measures, we're also talking about what do we have left to measure?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What kind of system do we now have in place? And so if there is a way to capture that piece of information along with performance measures, given the budget note, that would be very helpful. We're talking about a different world and a different universe than existed back when the budget note was developed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there's a part of this discussion that's sounding kind of strange.
Disconnected.
For me, disconnected okay. is a good
sure.
word.
Mm-hmm.
One of the pieces that comes to my mind is realizing, for example, that we no longer have a crisis
mm-hmm.
Service right. in any county. So what does that mean in terms of performance measures? What are we measuring? I think I'm making myself
mm-hmm. I think, Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, what we can do is a combination of if Clyde can bring back some additional information on what the performance-based contracts are looking like, and then we can have the mental health folks take a look at, because they have the performance measures, which of those performance measures are being adversely affected by the budget.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, because Multnomah County has been used as an example in our conversation, in all fairness to Multnomah County, I think it's important that we that we have information that is current that tells us what is the status now of Multnomah County, so that we're not continuing to spend what the past errors and omissions were all about, because there was enough fault all the way around, whether you want to look at the county, the state's role, or what did or didn't happen in the county. But I'd like us to be dealing with the current facts.
I this is not about fault.
Right.
This is about setting up a system.
Yes.
To where on an ongoing basis you have the tools with which to talk about what the outcomes have been, and it actually does serves multiple purposes. It allows policymakers to actually frame and look at what really is occurring, what maybe we need to shore up, and vice versa. It also, I think, I know my panel, my committee last session, we really wrestled with whether or not we were getting the results based on the dollars that we were providing, whether or not when we saw the numbers, that the numbers were recycled through. There were just wasn't enough data or information there to talk about outcomes. And so the accountability piece continues to come before this body.
Can I have a clarification?
Yes.
Clarification is, Senator Gordley and to Jean, and I forgot your name.
It's Clyde.
Clyde.
Yes.
My comments were meant to be forward-thinking, because this is something you're just putting into place, and I don't want to look backwards. You know, my philosophy is if you keep looking backwards and walking forward, you run into something and you don't see it. So mine is forward-thinking. I just gave Multnomah County as an example.
Right.
Because after serving on this committee for all of the 18 years I've been here, I know of all the county mental health services around the state and who is fee-for-service and who's managed care. So it's not looking backwards, but it's just giving hope to the future. Now that you've put these performance measures in place, hopefully they can be a warning to us for the future, that we see things before they actually get as bad as some of the situations have been.
Mm-hmm. What is the pilot county?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I am not sure what that is, because I just got the information on the budget note just before I left. But what I'll do between now and tomorrow, I'll bring back a status report on the county, along with any templates we have for you to look at. So I'll bring back a complete.
You had indicated that you had a pilot county. Who is the pilot county?
Madam Chair, left without that information today, but I will bring it back tomorrow along with all the other information you requested.
You can sit down outside. Until it's your time.
I have to come back?
Yes, you have to come back.
We'll be good, Clyde.
That's right. Oh, Madam Chair, to continue on page 2-1, as I noted, we have gone through this centralization over the last several biennium and culminating during the current biennium. And I had noted that we've been able to have much more consistency across our various program areas and how we deal with some of these administrative functions. We've also been able to accomplish efficiencies. And when Clyde comes back up for his real presentation, I think as he walks you through that, he'll be able to talk with you also about how we've been able, by combining these functions from the various divisions and program offices, to continue doing what we need to do, but with less bodies, or to absorb additional workload, perhaps without adding or having to add as many positions. I think what this has also allowed us to do in terms of centralizing these functions is to have a better understanding of the linkages across programs, because I think this is especially true as you'll get into finance and policy analysis, that as you've probably already discovered through the various presentations, our programs interrelate. And so you can have someone coming in at the SPD door, Seniors and Persons with Disabilities door, that directly affects. I paid big at the beginning of the session to Representative Bates.
That's not the same thing to her, because she put it at 20th.
That's right. Well,
I
have a prepaid capitation model.
You know that I have a lot of sergeant at arms and lectures on this.
Okay. Now, where was I? Someone may come in through the door of Seniors and Persons with Disabilities, and it directly affects the budget for the Oregon Health Plan, because that person not only is eligible for long-term care, but then also eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. So by centralizing the staff, I think they're much better understanding of the kinds of linkages that we have across programs. It also has allowed us to have department-wide leadership on issues such as around human resources and some of our other areas that we may not have had the critical mass before. But having said that, there certainly are challenges, and we have not addressed all of those challenges at this point. And I think it was something that became very evident to me as I came back into the department. And that is, we need to make sure that we don't let the administrative services functions drive program. They are there to support program. And so part of the balance here is how to get the efficiencies and consistencies while still respecting that each of these programs has different federal constraints, different statutory constraints, different reporting requirements. And so I think that the current leadership we have in these positions is certainly taking that to heart. Most of them have come from programs where they may have experienced some of those concerns. And so we really are trying to see how can we, in these various functional areas, still make sure that there's expertise on the programs so that there is a point person to go to or point people to go to who understand what the functions are, for instance, of the Office of Medical Assistance Program as they're working through human resources issues, those types of things. So those are certainly the challenges, is to make sure that as we get the efficiencies, we're still there, those support services really still are supporting programs, and we have enough expertise and the linkages between the programs offices. I'd like to turn to a minute to there's a portion of your in here of and Sheila alluded to it, a portion of the department which is no more, and I had mentioned it actually 3 months ago or so when I came and did the overview of the department, and that is continuous system improvement, which actually is under it's a little ways back as a separate tab. Continuous system improvement had been set up as a separate cluster with a little over 20 staff. It was really focused on, I guess I would say, being some of the drivers for the change that is necessary as we move through reorganization and service integration. Primarily what continuous system improvement did was focus on performance data. Most of the resources were around department-wide training, around process improvement, system improvement, other kinds of more generic training that might be necessary as we work through initiating and managing change. As well as within that training section, we now have, and remember, we have over 9,000 employees, online registration for programs, a lot of distance learning, trying to do our training in the most efficient way possible. And also, that unit ended up chairing a lot of departmental committees on various initiatives that we might have been looking at. One of the things when I came in as director, I thought it was important that we really look closely, given all of the reductions we were making, at how critical those functions were to supporting kind of our core business, our core programs, and whether or not we needed, assuming if they were critical, if whether or not we should continue having them in a separate cluster, so to speak, or whether we could achieve some efficiencies. We had discussions with Cabinet, and I think that they felt very strongly this is not the time to abandon our work around performance measures. As you've just talked about, it becomes even more important that we know where we're headed and where we are in relationship to that. Training, as we are downsizing and going through the kinds of program changes as we've been experiencing and likely still will experience, is probably more important than ever that people receive the training, not only the program training, but the training that allows them to do their jobs in the most efficient way possible, such as around process improvement. How do we take the processes we have and make them, streamline them, make them efficient? We did not, however, think it was necessary to do that as a separate cluster, so to speak, even though it was nice to have someone to go to head up all those department-wide committees. So we did make the decision that we wanted to continue those functions, but we have gone ahead and moved those functions out to other parts, actually, of department-wide support services. So the performance measures, the staff who worked on performance measures, are now in finance and policy analysis where they can link up more directly with the budget work that's being done. Recognizing what I don't think is just a one-time crisis, but probably some ongoing needs, we did, even before the so-called sixth special session, added a couple of temporary staff to the governor's advocacy office. We did move two positions in there to help staff up that, and those will continue in the governor's advocacy office, because even though we have a current blip, we will have, with loss of continued loss of services, a continued need.
Jean, within your structure, do you have a contract compliance operation?
I'm not sure, Madam Chair, what in terms
contract
of
compliance.
Contract monitoring.
Mm-hmm.
The monitoring is, I think there are probably two levels of monitoring, and the program monitoring continues to be the responsibility of the program offices, if that's what you were. If that's what you were suggesting.
Well, just that if you're moving towards not only performance-based, but in looking at whether or not your partners are actually carrying out the intent of contracts, usually there is a function of what's called contract monitoring, and I just wanted to...
Yeah. Madam Chair, I think that when Clyde does... I'm going to give Clyde another assignment. When Clyde does come up to talk about his part of the organization, perhaps he can speak to some of what we're trying to do around contract monitoring and training around that, because that is really a function of the program staff.
Stop. May I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Smith.
I don't want to derail you too much. I'm not sure when to ask this question. But through all of this reorg and shifting priorities and services within your organization, have you been able to, was there a reduction in FTE throughout the department? And how much is that and what's it done?
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I think especially as Clyde goes through his discussion around administrative services, I think he probably has information in here that will go through each of these various functions and talk about where there's either been a reduction in staff or where they've been able to absorb additional staff. In this particular part that I've just been talking about, continuous systems improvement, the bottom line is that we are in the process of abolishing 8 positions, 5 manager positions and 3 vacant representative positions. So as we move into 03-05, those will be positions. I mean, frankly, what we've done is we've moved the functions out, whether it's to finance and policy analysis or human resources, and the managers there are absorbing it. But we were able to abolish 5 manager positions.
The positions, I knew what you meant. You got rid of the positions. Are the people gone, or have they been absorbed in other areas?
Yeah, we are, Representative Smith, we are in the, we have actually Two of the people have moved into other permanent manager positions. The other three do have layoff notices as of June 30th and are continuing to compete for other positions and are working on other transition planning or other particular projects. The other three positions that were classified positions are vacant. And so we have where it's been appropriate, people have moved into other vacant positions. So, for instance, the person who had been the deputy in continuous system improvement, the person who was managing the central processing branch for the health plan is retiring, or maybe has retired, actually. And so the person who was deputy had that kind of background, and so she has moved into that position to take over management of that unit.
Thank you.
I think, as I noted, we've moved some of the training and some of the more technical issues around training, distance learning, to human resources, and we do have two of the positions that are focused on process improvement, on really how to help particular areas of the department analyze and improve their processes are in administrative services. So I think that, again, as far as continuous systems improvement, the functions themselves we think are important functions. We think we can do it more efficiently by moving it out to other parts of the department. And what that has also meant is that other members of cabinet and others have had to pick up some of the leadership for some of the department-wide work groups that we talked about. That means more workload on others. On the other hand, what it also does is require some others to have more ownership in the processes. We can't send it off to a group up there to be responsible for some of the department-wide initiatives. So we think that as we're looking at cutbacks, it was appropriate to make this cutback. So I think with that, what I'd like to do, I think after Pam does her presentation, is actually move from there, and Jim Neely will present more information about the director's office itself and the governor's advocacy office, and we can move into kind of the actual overview of the various parts of department-wide support services.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Pam Teschner with the Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management. And you have in front of you that presentation document that I'm sure you're used to seeing now that looks like the spiral. And page 2 of that document lays out points of time in the budget development. But as Sheila said, it does get a bit confusing when you're trying to compare one column to the next because of changes that were incorporated at one point that haven't been incorporated within the governor's budget. And so it makes it difficult to do a cross comparison. And with this prorate elimination that was incorporated at one point still is yet to be incorporated in the governor's budget. So it does make it tough. But this single story that you've already heard that is the theme of this song is the consolidation of administrative services into department-wide support services. So that is really the underlying story. And as we go forward through the rebalance and the reshoot, the numbers will be adjusted and corrected. So it is a little tough to make some sense out of some of that information, and I apologize for that, but we will be dealing with that. The pie chart on page 3 shows how the other funds, general fund and federal funds, is split in the governor's budget. Again, that big chunk of other funds will be reduced as this adjustment is made and the prorate that was described by Sheila is eliminated. You'll see that other funds shrink down a bit and that money distributed into general fund and federal funds. Page 4, I guess, again, the highlight is in that first bullet, the major changes approved by the 2002 first through fifth special session is the consolidation of administrative services and the transfer of funding. And also, again, as has already been mentioned, the reduction in the reinvestment funds. The total reduction at this point in time is approximately $3.3 million. And so, like Sheila said, there's about $2.4 million left that's being reinvested. And we've talked already about the major programs and services, finance and policy analysis, human resources, information systems, financial services and training. The when you look at the total funds on page 5 as far as how it splits between the two areas of central administration program support, you know, the bulk of that is in central administration. 97% of the money is in that area. And of that almost $357 million, a large piece of that is information systems, which is at roughly $170 million. A large part of it is, second largest piece is facilities, and the third largest piece in that area is financial services. In looking at how that same total fund amount is split between category, as you can see, the 62% of that is services and supplies. Personal services make up about 36%. And in that services and supplies group, a large part of that money is in the Medicaid Management Information System. And also a large chunk goes out for rent. The little teeny sliver of special payments is some money that is sent to the Disabilities Commission. And when you heard their budget, they that is the bulk of their budget that's coming from, it's coming from DHS. The seventh page there, let's see, again, there was, because of this consolidation and the transfer of positions and department-wide support services, you had that roll-up of position actions that added about $47 million of general fund to this budget as positions were moved and transferred. Page 8 is where the essential, the packages...
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to jump back to page 6 for a second. Your medical management information system is undergoing significant change right now, most of which is funded by the federal government. I understand that. What part of that $132 million you think is being dedicated to the medical management information system? Because I don't want to pay any money out today.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, the upgrade of the system or the...
The upgrade, maintenance of the system, both. I mean, the FTEs for it, the cost for that system, upgrades and everything.
I think I am doing a guess here that if $170 million of the budget is for information technology, I would guess somewhere around 75% of that is for the Medicaid Management Information System. I think when the John Cuddy, who's our chief information officer, will be presenting the information technology budget in more detail, so he'd be able to go through, and then of that, how much, and this is total funds, how much of that is actually for the expansion, and we received 90-10 match on that.
Chair Power.
Follow up.
I know you receive a 90-10 match. We put up 10, they put up 90. I'm interested in the efficiency of the model, and that means what kind of information you're getting in and out of it. You know, I know you do claims processing probably for long-term health care and probably for fee-for-service for OHP and probably, I got a couple bucks there.
You got a couple bucks to go into Rosie. You missed it.
And I'd like to know,
we'll
claim
I'd
like to have an idea of what it costs per claim.
Okay.
Because in the private world, that's how we do it. And, you know, we try to get information other times. It's very difficult to do. And I know it's difficult for you to process that because your system's probably a little different than just simple claims mm-hmm. management. But that is a significant cost for your agency. I'd like to get a little more information about it if we could.
Okay. We'll do that.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, there is a little bit of information about the package that the department brought forward in order to fund that into 0305 that we'll hit in a moment, too. The essential packages, as there were three essential packages there on page 8 that were included in the department's budget. The 010 packages you've heard is the vacancy factor and non-state personal services. It added 1.2 million total funds and just a smidgen of general fund. In that also is included, I think, a fairly significant chunk is for differentials that folks get, language differentials, for example. the O2O phase in and phase out package netted, there was some phase in, mostly phase out.
Pardon me?
Uh-huh.
You said there's a differential for language. Do we hire people with dual language skills?
Madam Chair, the department can probably answer that better than I, but from what I understand, they hire staff that do have multiple language, ability to speak multiple languages, then that can then be used, especially in field offices where there's a need for that. And I think that's been has had a significant increase.
Madam Chair, I think in terms, I'm not sure what the differential is, but just to give you an example, yesterday I was making a whirlwind visit in Portland, and I was at the Northeast Self-Sufficiency Office, and first I went to a jobs club that was being held in Spanish, and then I went to another room where it was held in Russian, and then I went to another room where it was computer-assisted, but the workers there spoke Arabic and Somali. And so I think we have such a variety of people in our system that, yes, we certainly have a number of staff who we recruit and hire who are bi or trilingual.
And as I, Madam Chair, as I look back to it, some of the information in the budget overview in this book, they point out, the department points out that of that 1.2 million total funds, about 740,000 of that is specifically for that differential. The O2O package, the decrease of almost $21 million of total funds there is the result of phasing out some information systems projects, either through the completion of those projects or through bringing that forward as a policy package. So there was the phase out of information systems projects there. The O3O package has the inflation and price list adjustments, and as I note, the general fund increases, at least part of those general fund increases, were eliminated in the governor's budget in the 092 package. There were a number of policy packages that begin on page 9 for package 080, which is the June 2002 emergency board, the Oregon Health Plan 2 positions, funding those for a few months, and then later in package 083, the October emergency board then funded them through the remaining part of that biennium, and these costs then roll into 0305. So that's what those two packages.
And those packages, the funding of the OHP two positions,
right,
was predicated on the expansion.
Right.
Waivers.
Madam Chair, it was both the expansion and then there may have been some of these. I'm not sure if there were ones in here that were based on having additional complexity because of having more than one benefit package, for instance, which is different than we've had in the past.
Package 081 that came out of the third special session is kind of a combination of things, from eliminating the cost of living increase for salary range 38 and above, transferring the Office of Multicultural Health into, or transferring funds to the Office of Multicultural Health. There were nine limited duration positions that supported the mental health payment system that were converted to full-time, and that resulted in $1.1 million of total funds and $200,000 of general fund. The November 2002 e-board, which is package 084 on the top of page 10 there, again, some reduction to reinvestment funds occurred there, also transferring the data entry unit into Department-wide Support Services. The Price Waterhouse contract was transferred, which I understand is the actuarial firm that determines the rates for the Oregon Health Plan. And the reinvestment funds that had been portioned out to the various divisions all being transferred into department-wide support services. So in the end, that netted an increase of $5.8 million total funds, $4.2 million general fund. Package 091 is the list of the effects.
How much is the Price Waterhouse contract?
Madam Chair, I don't have that. We'll get that for you.
Might be listed. Dr. Bates, Representative Bates, do you know?
No, Madam Chair, I don't know, and it's an excellent question. There's additional questions about the entire operation there. That's one we're looking at in the audit committee, and Gene's been a big part of that discussion. I believe we can get that information for you, mm-hmm. but I haven't got my fingertips.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Dean can bring it.
We'll bring it back.
Thank you.
Okay. The details of package 091 there from the fifth special session are listed from the, again, another reduction in the reinvestment funds of about $2 million. There, the elimination of some administrative positions. The number of positions at that point was 24 positions, 23.5 FTE. There were some reductions, some cuts in information technology projects of $2.4 million total funds, and the reductions in seniors and people with disabilities had a reduction in administrative services that were associated with those program-level reductions. And then on page 11, package 092 is where the general fund inflation increase that was in 030 was eliminated. And here's the policy package that was included in the governor's budget for the Medicaid Management Information System. The 99 legislature provided the initial funding, and it was continued by the 2001 legislature, and this requests continued funding for into 2003-05, and this package for 03-05 adds about $70 million of total funds, $7.5 million general fund. And package 162 is the transfer of the child support program to the Department of Justice. It's in House Bill 2340. Most of that is coming out of children, adults, and families cluster, and a little bit of it is coming out of this area of department-wide support services. Just $1.3 million total funds and $500,000 general fund. The whole package itself, including children, adults, and families, is almost $97 million of total funds being transferred to Department of Justice. And package 163 is the Women, Infants, and Children's Information Tracker, which you can see the acronym for that, and that's continued funding of that. And that's 100% federal fund, so there's no general fund. And again, that's to replace an outdated system. And the last two packages there on page 12, package 164 adds a position. Apparently there's one staff position designated to monitor, oversee, and expand the Medicaid school-based health services. And it adds $83,000 federal fund and other funds there. The last one is contained in House Bill 2342, and it clarifies probate timelines, and it has to do with clarifying there's apparently a phrase within 2 years from date of death, and there is some clarification of that, and the assumption is that will reduce the need for Attorney General assistance, and so there will be a slight reduction to the department's budget as a result of that.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. It would be very helpful for me, and I believe for the committee, if you could provide for us, Gene, a breakdown of the before and the after, an organizational chart that shows positions before FTEs, positions and FTEs before and after. When I look at the funding, and I look at the department-wide services, and then I look at the central support services for the respective agencies under your umbrella, the numbers don't suggest that we have actually reduced. I mean, that's intuitively that's the question I'd like to have answered in terms of how we. Has the reorganization worked? That's the fundamental question. And help us understand what has been done, me particularly, mm-hmm. being new, where we were and where we are. Mm-hmm. would be, I think, very, very helpful.
Okay. Certainly, Senator Morris will put that together and bring it back.
Thank you.
Okay.
So that it's a clear picture, it's the before and after on the FTEs, but you might also would include any action that was taken by this body that resulted in a change.
Yes.
Because I think that's, and I'm thinking of the example that after the reorg, when we looked at, I believe it was the food stamp outreach, if I recall correctly, that the e-board added some positions. And were you? I think we did.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to do that because I think, as I noted in response to some earlier questions, in some cases, I think Clyde will be able to go through and actually discuss where we've reduced, but in other cases, there may have either been, we've either been able to absorb additional workload that may have occurred with existing positions, or we do have some increases in positions because of other actions that have been taken, but we'll try to pull those out of what the major components were in terms of efficiencies or things that actually have been added, so when you see the positions, you know what it's net of.
Follow up.
Thank you. And then to include positions that are vacant in that organization chart as well. Thank you.
Okay. And in looking at those, I know that staff, just to weigh in on the vacant position, that staff is working with the various agencies to clean up the pick, to make sure certain that there aren't duplications and whatever. So you need to do that before you come back with what is actually vacant. I know in our, the committee in general government this morning, we went through that to make certain that we are talking about truly vacant positions.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, what I'd like to do now is turn the presentation over to Jim Neely, who is our deputy director, and he'll walk you through the director's office, and also he will have Jim Dennison join you to specifically discuss the governor's advocacy office.
Welcome, Jim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Neely, Department of Human Services. And joining me will be Jen Dennison. As Sheila indicated, in addition to the director's office having the overall responsibility for leadership and policy development of the department, the director's office also has a handful of specialized functions that support the entire department, and I want to talk just a little bit about a couple of those. If you turn to page 4-3, talk just a minute about our tribal relations liaison. Rick Acevedo is our tribal relations liaison, a unit of one individual. And this position helps us maintain state government relations with the 9 federally recognized tribes in the state, as well as other Indian communities in Oregon, and helps resolve a number of issues and helps coordinate our programs with their programs. And just as an example, we have an overlap in program area with the tribes, 10 major program areas that we overlap in. Including areas such as health, mental health, addiction services, child welfare, and temporary assistance to needy families. And in fact, currently 2 Oregon tribes, the Siletz and the Klamath tribes, have their own temporary assistance to needy family programs. And in fact, Klamath tribe was the first tribe in the country to operate a temporary assistance to needy families program. Switching over to page 4-4, audit and consulting services, and Madam Chair, this area helps get at some of your and perhaps Senator Carter's questions about how we make sure that programs and contracts are working as they should. With a $9 billion budget, I think it's very important that we understand that our programs are working, how well they're working, and take the time to look at them and see how they could work better. And rather than just relying on the occasional Secretary of State's audit to try and point out those areas where we could improve, we do some of this on our own. So the Audit and Consulting Services Unit in the Director's Office is split pretty much evenly between Medicaid provider audits and the internal audits group. For Medicaid provider audits, they really do four different things there. Identify and recover overpayments, educate providers. It's not just a gotcha, but actually helping our providers understand the complex Medicaid regulations so that they bill us appropriately. It helps deter inappropriate billings as well. And they also help recommend program improvements so that next time we do something, we do it better. Internal audits really helps us take a look at all of our program areas to figure out, in specific, what we could do better, what may be falling through the cracks, what we're not paying enough attention to. They help us look at the risk areas and make sure we're paying attention to those areas where there's some exposure. And just as an example, in the 0103 biennium thus far, this group has identified, it says here, $3.1 million. That was when this was printed. We're about $3.4 million in Medicaid overpayments, and at this point, all of those have been recollected from providers right now. So I think it's very important that we, with a budget of this size, that we pay attention to how our programs are operating and make sure they're operating efficiently. With that, I'm going to ask Jen Dennison to talk a little about the Governor's Advocacy Office at having had a slight increase in business here lately. Jen?
Thank you, Jen. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Winters and members of the committee, I'm Jen Dennison, Administrator of the Governor's Advocacy Office. Our office is comprised technically of four programs. I'm going to stop right there and say, Sheila, if you wouldn't mind, I came financially unprepared. Should I blurb? If you would keep track of what I owe Rosie, I would appreciate it very much, because I'll probably owe her a lot by the time I'm done here. I'm going to group our ombudsman functions into one grouping, which consists of, in statute, the Children's Ombudsman, and by Senate confirmation, I am Oregon's Children's Ombudsman. The other piece of our program in the ombudsman function that is in statute is the over 65 and disabled Medicaid population. The remainder of the ombudsman functions for the department are not in statute. They're at the direction of the director of our department. The other programs within the Governor's Advocacy Office are the Pain Management Program. Some of the important pieces that program has done last session was pass the Pain Management Commission bill, which created a commission to look at developing training curricula for healthcare providers on how to train healthcare providers on the management of intractable and chronic pain issues. They also have a great website. I would encourage you to go to the Department of Human Services website and take the link to the pain management website. It's very informative. It has a track you can take if you're a consumer and another track you can take if you are a healthcare provider. The other program is the Alternate Format American with Disabilities Act program. That program is a result of a lawsuit by our clients who did not receive materials in the appropriate format for their needs, such as Braille, audio cassette, needing to have information provided to them person to person. One of the best pieces that's come out of that program is that we are now able to track the cost to produce those materials. We didn't have a history because it was done by different points within the department. Now it's under a contract by one person, so she can manage and keep track monthly on what those costs are to provide materials to our clients. One of the pieces I did want to share with you, since Jim mentioned our business is just booming these days, I put together a time frame of January through April 24th, which is when I prepared these statistics, of last year and this year, and our caseload is 1,320 more actually worked cases than it was over the same time frame last year. I'm really grateful for the two positions that we were able to inherit from Continuous Systems Improvement. Those folks came to us with skills and knowledge of our department, which really have been a benefit. One had work vocational rehabilitation, one had mental health and developmental disabilities experience in the past. they both also know how to do mediation, which is what we do all day long. So they've been a real asset to our unit. With the monies that came to us from the sixth special session, we were able to hire some temporaries who are multilingual, which has been also a big benefit. We have one employee who speaks four languages, and unfortunately she's on maternity leave, so we really had a big gap to fill in hiring the temps, and they have come in and just done a fantastic job for us. So that is a brief overview of our office.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. I would just like to inquire about the current workload, and let me also say I think you're an angel. Been following your work. The current caseload is 1,300.
Senator Gordley, Madam Chair, at the moment, that the statistic I gave you is for January 1st of 03 through April 24th of 03, and the total numbers for that time frame were 2,578. For the time frame last year, same time frame, was 1,258. So those were cases. What I didn't tell you is we also have statistics on toll-free phone calls that come in. We have 8 phone lines. We also receive emails. So we're jockeying 3 email boxes throughout the day, as well as 8 phone lines with a toll-free line that rolls into. So total volume I don't have, but cases is what I did prepare for you, was that actual number of cases worked. It is a little bit less, I think, this month than it was last month. February and March were absolutely unbelievable.
Mm-hmm. Do you have... Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have enough people to meet the demand?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, from the gift of the special session and the inheritance of two positions, at the present time we do, and what I'll give you a breakdown right now in ombudsman functions, we have 10 people, including myself. That's the 4 existing or permanent ombudsman folks, which include me. Then we have the 2 new permanent employees that we inherited, and then we have 4 temporary employees.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Are you also working extended hours, evenings and weekends? Is that still accurate?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, thank you for reminding me. Yes, we are. We have 2 staff that work from 10 to 7 p.m. The rest of the staff work from 8 to 5 p.m. And business has increased between 5 and 7 p.m. They're getting used to us being there.
Thank you.
I don't think it's any secret that your chair worked very hard to increase the number of staff for the governor's advocacy office, recognizing the increased caseload that had come into that office as a result of the reductions that had taken place. That office has done a yeoman's job when we think of what was occurring in the communities as a result of the reductions. And I personally want to just say thank you, Jen, and your staff. You, and I know that you were putting in more than 10 hours a day. I know that your staff was totally exhausted before we actually added some staff to you. I think if you do some comparisons of the various offices that are, quote, ombudsman, quote, unquote, I think you will find that this particular office and the work that they do in resolving caseworkers is at the very top of the list. I have, having come from the place where I was the state ombudsman, I have observed since I've been back the activity of the various offices, and this GIN's office, and I can't say enough, if you look at the volume and you look at the cases that have been resolved and the work that they do, I think we all need to say to her and her staff and the department a job well done. And I just have to put that on record because it has been, I know it was tremendous, the amount of responsibility that we placed there when we were going through the House Bill 5100 and what happened with the fallout of the non-passage of Measure 28. So I just want to personally say thank you. Representative Smith.
Very good, Madam Chair.
When folks call up to use your assistance, is it because their benefits have run out, and or what kind of calls do you get? What do you do for them specifically? Because I think my office has referred some of my constituents because I didn't know what to do with them, you know. And so what do you do?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, mm-hmm. the issues run from the ridiculous to the most serious things you can imagine. The folks who were an organ transplant who did lose their prescription coverage mm-hmm. so that the immunosuppressant drugs were no longer an option for them, mm-hmm. how were they going to live? And when you weigh what the cost of the transplant procedure was, mm-hmm. the cost of the drugs each month, this is just horrendous. And so many of those folks, depending on what the transplanted organ was, were able to function well and be employed. So one of the things we do best is we listen. We're great problem solvers, and each of us are very passionate about service and how can we meet the needs of the public. And I think that's the thing that we benefit all of you the mm-hmm. most is we truly listen. Mm-hmm. I often say we're a cross between a missionary and a detective because we're trying to save the situation while we're hunting for the pieces to do so.
So are you
following?
You're able then, the transplant patient, let's just pursue that further. Were you able to find some place or somebody or from the meds?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, one of the best things has been, especially the new website of healthyoregon.org, and the public-private partnership that has developed. This is my going into the 14th year being an ombudsman and pretty much most of it in human services. This has been the most exciting thing for me to see the legislative body work with us as an agency and the private sector to step forward and say, what can we do to help these folks? And I think that's just a phenomenal feat. And I have to thank the Senator, Senator Winters, for the efforts that she put into that. Many of the folks do qualify for the free drugs. Many do not. And my staff and I hear every day, so you're telling me I'm going to die. And that's one of the hardest things that we have to hear, because they're saying to me, you've just given me a death sentence.
Mm.
And I've had to learn, as my staff has, that it isn't a personal thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I often say, if I were queen, we'd have everything, but that isn't an option. So we try to problem solve and say, are you part of a church community? Do you have extended family? What is your friend group? Who do you know? How can we help connect you to something that's going to help you? Because when the issue is you, often it's so close to you, you don't know where to go to get the help.
Oh.
Follow up.
Thanks. So could you put a percentage on those people who you cannot help at all? Are you able to process that, you know?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, at the present time, it's a very high percentage. As I
50?
Said, I would say closer to probably 70%.
One of the things that it is this chair's desire, and it's no secret, those of you who know that I was the former ombudsman, that as the various ombudsmen are in their day-to-day work and what they do, often they can come up with trend line information that can assist policymakers and the governor's office with immediately having access to make, you know, some broader policy changes. I think the bill that I have in Senator Cochran's committee was to begin to give the ombudsman some entree into that process where they're actually reporting to the governor on a quarterly basis. It's interesting to me. We have structure a pool of staff who are actually troubleshooters, who actually are, I think Governor McCall would have put it another way, and that was that often our systems become so rigid, and that's the bureaucracy itself, mm-hmm. that you need an entity or entities that can go through and cut through the red tape and mm-hmm. begin to get down, and if you, but Jen and others do, they do cut through the morass and are able to assist in resolving problems that citizens have with their government. In addition to that, there are also sometimes places where they cannot make change, but yet they do have recommendation for changes. And it's my hope that one day we will have the ombudsman elevated to a place in the state of Oregon where they do have direct access to both the governor and this legislative body. I see them as a very viable tool. Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, you may be able to give us information that actually nobody else can give us, and that's concerning programs like the Medically Needy Program, which Representative Smith alluded to. We've got anecdotal stories, but no real significant data about what's happened to those people. We've temporarily put money back in the program, but we don't know what's going to happen July 1st if we don't buy that program back. You may have a feel for that because you went through several weeks when people might have been calling you for that program, and I would like to have an idea of what that was like for you. You normally wouldn't have been called by those people. Something changed. I expect or think you may have gotten a lot of calls. And you just stated that you thought maybe 70% of those people, you couldn't resolve their problem for them. You couldn't get them into a pharmaceutical program to cover their drugs, sent them to friends, family, church groups to try to cover the cost of those drugs, which can easily run $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month. So I guess what I'm really asking you for, what is your sense of the need, how serious it is, chances of people actually dying because we aren't funding this program after July 1st, so that will guide me in deciding and trying to get that program bought back.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, one of the things we've done as we've had contact from the public was we've coded in keywords on our intake form, whether it was a medically needy issue, budget cut, so that we can go through later on and pull out statistics. I can tell you life was hell during about a four-week period of time. My expectation is by the third week in June, it's going to repeat itself because we're going to be pretty much back to where we were the end of January and through February and March. Many of the folks, and I want to say Oregon has been a very generous state in providing services to our public that many states do not provide. And we're now at a budget time when we can't be as generous with our general fund dollars as we've been able to be in the past. And I think the average citizen doesn't understand general fund pretty much is income tax dollars. So we have high unemployment, recession time. There's no money in the kitty, so we can't pay. So one of the things we've been able to do for all of you is explain general funds and where it comes from. Federal funds, dedicated funds, what they do, what can mix, what can't mix. And I really value the training I have as former governor's staff because I have that knowledge and was able to train my staff. So when the citizen calls, we can say, you know, we've laid off people too. We didn't get a raise. I understand you're in pain. I know your needs are much worse than ours, but we can help. And sometimes it's just to listen.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Follow up. Could you share that information? You've obviously collated it in some way, and I'd like to have, if you could share that with us, it would be very helpful, not only for this committee, but for others. And some idea of where we might be in late June, as we enter what will probably be either the last of our budgeting or maybe we're through by then. But I'd like to see the information if you could.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, one of the things I've encouraged my staff to do is if you can take vacation time, let's do it now because we know what it's going to be like the end of June and July because there's not going to be any break time.
Thank you.
Senator Shields.
Yeah, my question is somewhat repetitive of Dr. Bates, and that is simply that we need to know more about that 70% that you say can't be helped, you know, within your criteria, because I'm assuming that they were all being helped at some point previously, and now we've brought it down, and we just need a clear understanding of the consequences of our budgetary actions.
Madam Chair, for clarification, the 70% would be of those I've heard from, not of the general population. So of those we've heard from, 70% we were not able to help.
Yeah.
That's a very important statement. Thank you.
Senator Shields, one of the, in the bill that's sitting in the good senator's committee would require that the various ombudsmen have a quarterly report so that we're having access to that information in a fashion and in a way that it can assist in policy decisions. And I don't like to add a different an additional burden, but I do think that the work of the ombudsman is, and they have knowledge that, you know, we all are sitting here now, you know, wanting to hear more from what Ms. Dennison does and what the outcomes are. And I think the sharing of that information is very important as we make our decisions on budgets and other policy issues in the state.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, there are no more questions about the Director's Office. I'll invite Clyde Psyche back up to talk about administrative services.
You're on the right page here.
You want us to carry it over? We can start now, and then we're going to carry it over. You can pass out and they can read it tonight at home. Bedtime reading tonight.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again for the record, my name is Clyde Psyche and I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the Department of Human Services. And I would just like to state for the record that I am making my donation or paying my dues right up front. And I'm going to let somebody...
Is very grateful.
I'm going to let somebody else put it in there because last night as I was preparing, I had one of those flashes where I'd be trying to put the money in Rosie and knock her over and forever be known as the And then, well, what I was afraid of is that... I would then forever be known as the person who killed Rosie, and so I think that's something that I don't wish to be known as. So I will just leave it here, and perhaps Senator Carter, who's a Sergeant Arms
that's
today,
right.
could
I'll
do that for me.
Put it in.
And I knew this was going to be quite the day because, and I testified earlier in the session before. Representative Cruz and Representative Westland's committee, and at that time I told them that I had not had to do this for about 6 years now, and I was a little bit nervous about it, and as I was walking out to come to work today, my wife stopped me and asked me if I was nervous, and I said, no, I'm okay, and she said, well, I don't think you're okay, and when I asked her why not, she said, because you have a brown shoe and a black shoe on. and so I at that point in time, I decided I hope that we ran long and I didn't have to start today, but obviously that's not the case, so I will now begin.
Then you better be nice down there.
I don't know what you told me. You said make sure that I...
I will say for the record that when I did testify there for... before their committee, Representative Westland was very nice to me.
That's very good.
For a change.
So, Madam Chair, I will be presenting the overview for 6 of the 7 offices within the Administrative Services Cluster. And John Cuddy, our Chief Information Officer, will be making the presentation on information services because I know that's of particular interest to the committee because of the size of the IT budget and its importance in the organization. I just wanted to kind of begin with a brief overview, and the department really first began consolidating its administrative functions in 1996, and prior to that, each division had its own separate administrative services unit, which also meant that for each division, we had a chief information officer, for each division, we had a chief financial officer, and for each division, we had a head personnel manager. And one of the efficiencies we've gained, kind of to get to your question, Senator Morse, is that since we've begun the consolidation process, instead of 7 of these chief information officers or chief financial officers, we now have 1 for the department. So that, and as we present you with more information on the ARG charts, that'll kind of be reflected on where we were and where we are now. I think the other piece of it that was difficult for us is that we also had 7 sets of administrative policies and procedures, which means that each division had their own set of rules, administrative rules that governed the employees in that division. And one example I always use for people is that we really only have one process to reimburse employees for travel in this state, but in our old structure, the department had seven different travel forms and seven different processes for reimbursing our employees for travel, one for each division. And since that time, we have centralized all of that, and now for the department, we have one travel form and one process, so we don't have to maintain seven different processes.
I'm looking at your organizational structure, and you can get it back to me later because tomorrow or some other time. Mm-hmm. But in your forms design and distribution, I need to know how many forms you have. And then what is imaging and archiving? I know archiving is put in a place for some place for future posterity, but what is imaging?
Senator Winters, at this point in time, what we're doing is imaging is part of the OHP application process. And as the applications come in, so we image the application so that people can then work with electronic copies instead of hard copies of the forms.
So you're taking a copy of the forms and then storing the form?
We're storing it, but it also, because of the way we index, what they call index it, it also makes it a lot easier for people to find what they're looking for rather than digging through file drawers or using the hard copies. We have an indexing system that lets them find whatever the forms and everything that's attached to it.
Do a decimal system? I used to be a medical record librarian, so that is the system that they use.
Senator Winters, I'm not sure if that's the system they use, but they use some form of indexing to locate the forms when they're needed.
Okay.
And we will be able to, I'll bring back a count of forms for you tomorrow.
Well, I guess it would be a problem, but I would like to know the total number. So if the person who's listening is going to give this tomorrow, how many forms do you have, and how frequently are they merged and looking at consolidated for efficiency sake?
Right. And Senator Winters, I'll bring that back tomorrow. Administrative Services as an entity wasn't really formed until February of 2001, and it was part of the DHS reorganization. Our goal in forming Administrative Services was to increase efficiency, reduce unnecessary duplication, and also reduce confusion for DHS staff, clients, and contractors. It was very confusing for people because even though we were a department, if you looked at our administrative structure, you could have a very different experience depending on which division you were dealing with as far as any of the administrative functions. Our mission in administrative service is to support DHS through timely, accurate, effective, and consistent administrative systems. And to help us achieve that mission, we've established several goals, and I wanted to share with the committee three of what I think are the most important goals, and they're listed on page 4-13 of the handout. And the first goal really is the implementation of standardized business practices. Earlier in the presentation, I mentioned the fact that at one point in time, we had seven different travel forms and seven different travel reimbursement processes, which really led to a lot of inefficiencies and wasn't very cost-effective. By standardizing some of these processes, we've not only been able to gain efficiencies as far as staff, we've also cut down on processing time, and it's really led to increased effectiveness in a lot of the systems we've been able to re-engineer. The second goal is to increase the efficiency, effectiveness, and coordination of administrative services through the consolidation of the functions through the department. This consolidation has allowed us to maximize our resources and better utilize our staff resources because through kind of the standardization process, we're now able to move people to meet the workload as opposed to in the past. Because there were different processes, you were not able to kind of work across divisions because each division had a different process or a different procedure. And the other thing that we've been able to do through this whole process is we've been able to identify areas where we have duplication and then eliminate that duplication. And then the third goal is the establishment of department-wide policies and procedures. And again, having seven different policies and procedures was a very frustrating experience for our contractors, our vendors, and our staff included. And I think by implementing standardized policies and procedures, we've been able to increase effectiveness as well as cut down on confusion and frustration by our customers as well as our staff. I look at the services we offer as sort of the infrastructure services that you see in many of our cities and towns, services like bridges, water systems, roads. And really, the way I look at it is that these are all important services, but we really don't notice them or pay attention to them a lot of times until there's a problem with them. And then, once we have a problem, we realize how critical they are to the operation of our city or town. In administrative services, we are the business infrastructure part of the organization that a lot of time gets taken for granted as long as we're working smoothly. But as soon as we have problems, I think that we quickly realize how important these services are. One example I can give you is that 80% of our budget goes out to communities in the form of payments to contractors, providers, clients. And our accounting systems, our contracting systems, and our information systems all play a critical role in making these payments happen and making sure that the money gets to where it's needed. On page 4-14 of the handout, there's a list of the offices within the administrative services cluster. And our org chart that most of you have already seen is on page 4-16. And Chair Winders, the next part of my presentation is kind of an overview of the six offices. So I'd like to know at this point in time, would you like me to continue or maybe wait till tomorrow?
We're at 3 o'clock, and why don't we start fresh tomorrow,
okay.
And we won't let you step over Rosie and make sure you take not a brown shoe or a black shoe.
And don't be nervous.
And don't be nervous. And this is quite a harmless group, except for Representative Weston down there on the end.
Yes.
And I will make sure that he behaves. Representative Weston.
Madam Chair, we've been listening to this very excellent presentation minute, and we have not heard the information that we need to know.
And what might that be, Representative Weston?
Which shoe did you change out of this morning?
That's right.
The black one or the brown one?
Or did you?
Yeah, or did you?
Actually, the whole time I've been talking to you, I've been resisting this urge to check and make sure that I did. I'm pretty sure I did, but I've been sitting here with just resisting the urge to look down.
I believe that Senator Gordley wanted to ask the same
thing.
But I do have another pair just like them in the closet.
So just to know that tomorrow you don't have to worry about whether you have a brown one or a black shoe on, and that this really is a very friendly group, except for we have a couple exceptions down on that end. And with that, members, we are adjourned until tomorrow.